Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The full-scale war in Ukraine and conflicts, including in Sudan, have helped uproot a staggering 110 million from their homes worldwide so far this year. That's the shocking message from UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, which said that by the end of 2022, the number of people displaced by war, persecution, violence, and human rights abuses was at a record 108.4 million. That's up over 19 million from 2021, which was also the highest ever increase. Over 35 million were refugees, while some 62.5 million were internally displaced within their countries. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, also said that a record 43.3 million children were living in forced displacement last year, many of them for their entire childhood. UN data indicates that low- and middle-income countries host the most displaced people. Over 1 in 5 refugees worldwide is hosted by one of the world's 46 least developed nations. The UN Security Council has condemned a brutal attack on a camp for internally displaced people in Ituri province in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, which left at least 45 people dead on the 11th and 12th of June. The attack has been attributed to members of the Kodoko militia, one of many armed groups operating in the country's east that's plagued by violence and displacement. According to the UN Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, Ituri hosts 1.7 million displaced people. The Security Council called on the Congolese authorities to launch an investigation with the support of the UN peacekeeping mission MONUSCO and to bring the perpetrators to justice, noting that deliberate attacks targeting civilians may constitute war crimes. Members of the Security Council also reiterated their call on all Congolese armed groups to lay down their arms and participate in the UN-backed Nairobi process, a peace talks initiative brokered by the East African Community in 2022. The UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator, Martin Griffiths, called the attack horrific, while the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said that 23 children were among those killed and that it was unacceptable that families who had already fled their homes were once again the direct target of violence. A very severe cyclonic storm moving over the Arabian Sea is expected to make landfall close to the India-Pakistan border on Thursday, the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, has warned. WMO said that its regional specialized center in New Delhi, operated by the Indian Meteorological Department, predicts that Cyclone Biparjoy will hit the Indian and adjoining Pakistani coasts near Jakhau Port on the 15th of June with a maximum wind speed of up to 135 kilometers or 84 miles per hour. Torrential rainfall has already been seen in the coastal areas, WMO said, and warnings are being issued to fishermen in the area as a big storm surge is expected. WMO reiterated that accurate forecasts and early warnings play a crucial role in avoiding high casualties from tropical cyclones. The agency is leading a UN initiative to ensure that everyone on Earth is protected from extreme weather by early warning services by 2027. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Tuesday that it was on standby to support the authorities in Pakistan and in India to prepare for and respond to the storm. The governments of both countries have been evacuating people in the areas under threat, and WHO Pakistan has pre-positioned supplies, including oral rehydration salts, water purification tablets, and essential medicines in the affected districts. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. We are moving into the 90 degree Fahrenheit realm. That's right. We are now in a warming spree here in northeast Kansas. It's going to be interesting, up to 90 degrees possibly today and tomorrow, and thunderstorms are forecasted on the computer models, which means they may not happen exactly, but you never know. It is an interesting, slow news day. I find it very interesting that all the heat seems to happen. Tomorrow, on Friday, we'll probably hear some more news after the big Donnie Trump, you know, a court appearance. He goes across the peninsula to Miami, you know, from West Palm Beach to his golf course, the Doral there, course, gets in a huge traffic convoy of Secret Service and at least a couple hundred motorcycle cops and just unbelievable amount of money to protect this piece of shit. I mean, I can't believe it. It's unbelievable. It's wealthy piece of shit we're protecting, who probably pays as little taxes as he can get away with. And then they block up working people on the interstate highway running through Miami. Tens of thousands of cars backed up in a traffic jam, an artificial traffic jam, created not by our falling bridges, but by His Eminence going to a federal court to say not guilty. Well, that I don't know if we can top that this Friday. But I know what we could do here at Radio Free Kansas. Coming up in the second hour is the tax cast. This will be the last this month until the new one comes out. Naomi Fowler at the Tax Justice Network will produce a new one in a week or two, and we'll put it on. We're going to reserve this afternoon time next Thursday for some special programming. In the meantime, here is the promo to the tax cast in the second hour, followed by Democracy Now! Headlines. Hit it, Tristan.
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. See you then.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, a regional governor from Darfur was assassinated Wednesday after he publicly blamed the paramilitary rapid support forces and allied Arab militias for the genocide of civilians. West Darfur state governor Khamis Abakhar was abducted and killed hours after making the remarks in a TV interview. Reuters reports two government sources said the RSF was responsible for the killing. On Wednesday, the International Organization for Migration said fighting between rival military factions in Sudan has now displaced more than 2 million people from their homes, with more than 500,000 fleeing to neighboring countries. Nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed, according to a local monitoring group. In Ukraine, the mayor of Kryvyi Rih says Russian missiles struck two civilian industrial sites overnight, injuring at least one person. The attack came days after another attack on the central Ukrainian city killed 11 civilians. Elsewhere, Ukraine's military said it shot down 18 Russian drones over the Black City port, city of Odessa, overnight. And Russia's TASS news agency reports Ukrainian artillery fire killed a child in a Russian-occupied part of Kherson region. On Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin met with pro-war bloggers at the Kremlin, where he said Russia's military operations in Ukraine have been plagued by shortages of precision-guided munitions, communications gear, aircraft and drones, as well as other equipment, in a rare admission. The leader of Belarus said Tuesday he's received nuclear weapons from Russia and won't hesitate to use them if his nation's security is at stake. President Alexander Lukashenko made the remarks in an interview with a Russian state TV channel Tuesday evening.
We have missiles and bombs that we have received from Russia, both that are three times more powerful than the ones used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There, more than 80,000 people died instantly, 250,000 overall. That's from one strike. And this one is three times more powerful. I don't know, up to a million people would die immediately if, God forbid, this weapon were used.
Exiled Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya called on the world leaders to respond to Russia's first deployment of tactical nuclear weapons outside its borders since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. She wrote on social media, quote, "It creates a serious threat to regional security and sets us on a dangerous path for nuclear escalation. The world must show Lukashenko and Putin that it won't give in to nuclear blackmail." Thousands of protesters took to the streets of cities across Poland Wednesday after a pregnant woman died when medical workers refused to provide her with a life-saving abortion. 33-year-old Dorota Lalik died of sepsis in May, 3 days after her water broke, and she was admitted to the John Paul II Hospital. The hospital has deep ties to the Catholic Church, and medical staff there opted out of providing abortion care, citing a so-called conscience clause allowed under Polish law. This is a protester at Wednesday's pro-choice march in Warsaw.
I came here because I do not agree with women dying, that they have no choice, that doctors have a so-called conscience clause. If they want conscience clauses, they would change their profession. Women are dying because of them and also because of the law that has been established in Poland.
Here in the United States, the Justice Department has charged an active-duty Marine and one other person for firebombing a Planned Parenthood clinic in Costa Mesa, California, with a Molotov cocktail in March of last year. The two arrested men, Chance Brannon and Tibet Irgul, could face up to 20 years in federal prison. In related news, a new report from the Center for Countering Digital Hate finds Google made over $10 million from ads by anti-abortion groups. The Google ads were for so-called crisis pregnancy centers, which aim to steer people away from having abortions while posing as reproductive health care clinics. The Southern Baptist Convention has voted to uphold the expulsion of two churches led by women pastors, tightening the church's restrictions on women, banning them not just from serving as pastors, but from having any kind of leadership position. The moves come after organizing by the Southern Baptist Church's ultra-conservative members. In climate news, officials in India and Pakistan have ordered the evacuation of more than 150,000 people as Cyclone Biparjoy makes landfall in India's Gujarat state. The storm crashed ashore earlier today near high tide with a storm surge that threatened to inundate low-lying coastal areas. It's just the third cyclone to hit India's west coast in nearly six decades. Here in the United States, thick smoke from dozens of wildfires burning in Canada settled over Wisconsin and Minnesota Wednesday, triggering air quality alerts for very unhealthy levels of fine particle and ozone pollution. The air quality index topped 240 in the Twin Cities, the region's worst levels on record. President Biden's vetoed legislation that would have rolled back a new rule limiting emissions from heavy-duty vehicles. The White House says the rule change will cut nitrogen oxide emissions in half by 2045, preventing thousands of childhood asthma cases and premature deaths every year. The bill to repeal the tougher emissions cleared the Senate in April with the support of Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and with ALN California Senator Dianne Feinstein absent. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives has failed in its effort to override President Biden's veto of legislation that would have blocked police accountability legislation passed by the Washington, D.C. City Council in the wake of George Floyd's murder. 13 Democrats joined with House Republicans in voting to overrule the D.C. law, which expands access to police disciplinary records and body camera footage, limits the use of tear gas and other chemical agents, and bans certain police tactics, including chokeholds. Washington, D.C.'s non-voting delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, said in a statement, quote, "The disapproval resolution is a profoundly undemocratic and paternalistic piece of legislation. Almost 700,000 people live in the nation's capital, and they're worthy and capable of governing their own local affairs," unquote. Here in New York, A grand jury has indicted former U.S. Marine Daniel Penny over the killing of Jordan Neely on a city subway on May 1st. Penny, who's white, held Jordan Neely in a chokehold until he died. Neely, a beloved street performer, was unhoused and hungry, crying out for help when the ex-Marine attacked him. The charges will be unsealed when Penny's arraigned. The date of his arraignment is expected to be announced today. The Federal Reserve has decided to hold interest rates steady after 10 consecutive increases since early 2022. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren welcomed Wednesday's announcement by Fed Chair Jerome Powell, writing, quote, "The Fed raised interest rates at the fastest pace in decades, and it needs to maintain this pause or risk throwing millions of Americans out of work," unquote. The European Union has advanced a major new law that would regulate artificial intelligence as governments around the world grapple with how to respond to the possible threats of the fast-moving technology. The EU draft law includes restrictions on the use of facial recognition and mandates disclosures of data by makers of chatbots and deepfake videos. This is European Parliament's President Roberta Metsola.
Going forward, we are going to need constant, clear boundaries and limits to artificial intelligence. And here there is one thing that we will not compromise on. Anytime technology advances, it must go hand in hand with our fundamental rights and democratic values. And finally,
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently said he supports the idea of global watchdog for artificial intelligence that could play a role in similar to how the International Agency of Atomic Energy regulates nuclear technology.
The scientists and experts have called on the world to act, declaring AI an existential threat to humanity on a par with the risk of nuclear war.
Here in the United States, Jennifer DiStefano, an Arizona mother, testified at a Senate hearing this week about her harrowing experience with a deep fake scam that tricked her into thinking her daughter had been kidnapped. DiStefano says the fake kidnappers demanded a $50,000 ransom before she got in touch with her daughter, who was in fact safe and sound.
It was my daughter's voice. It was her cries. It was her sobs. It was the way she spoke. I will never be able to shake that voice and the desperate cries for help out of my mind. It's every parent's worst nightmare to hear your child pleading with fear and pain, knowing that they are being harmed and that you're helpless. The longer this form of terror remains unpunishable, the farther and more egregious it will become. There is no limit to the depth of evil AI can enable.
Meanwhile, election integrity groups have been sounding the alarm over the use of AI to misinform people ahead of the 2024 U.S. election. Florida's Republican governor, presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis, released an attack ad earlier this month showing AI-generated deepfake images of Donald Trump hugging and kissing Anthony Fauci. And a Guatemalan court Wednesday convicted prominent journalist Jose Ruben Zamora of money laundering and sentenced him to 6 years in prison, what rights groups have condemned as a trumped-up case and part of a crackdown on press freedom by the right-wing government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Zamora is the founder and president of the investigative newspaper El Periódico and has long reported on Guatemalan government corruption. The newspaper was forced to shut down in May after months of intensifying harassment and persecution. To see our interview with Jose Ruben Zamora's son, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us. Freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center talks about his new book, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America.
He explains the current radical right six-person supermajority on the Supreme Court and its implications for our health, safety, and constitutional rights.
After the USA Patriot Act became law, photographing federal buildings raised alerts by law enforcement. But the practice is far from illegal. In fact, many citizens engage in what's called First Amendment auditing. We'll hear how important this is for preserving our rights to free speech and freedom of the press. Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
In late June 2022, a package of Supreme Court decisions drastically altered the nation's legal landscape. It took just 3 days to roll back some of the most consequential gains for civil rights, voting, the separation of church and state, a woman's right to choose, and more. In his new book, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America, Michael Waldman offers an in-depth analysis of the 2022 key rulings and the radical ways in which they were crafted. He provides historical context for how the Supreme Court has amassed power far beyond what the framers intended, and how the current supermajority ascended to this high court. Waldman also points to previous courts on both the right and the left that overreached and describes their consequences for the country. Significantly, he writes that the seizure of so much power by a few members of the court and their energetic wielding of it poses a crisis for U.S. democracy. But a backlash against the court is underway. Rather than seeking a supermajority of their own, Waldman writes that, quote, liberals must fall out of love with the Supreme Court. He recommends reform measures to curb the court's power while applying other pressure points, such as in the court of public opinion. Michael Waldman is the president and CEO of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, a nonpartisan law and policy institute. An expert on the Constitution and the courts, Waldman served on President Joe Biden's commission on the Supreme Court. He is the author of The Fight to Vote and The Second Amendment, a biography. Michael Waldman was director of speechwriting during the Clinton administration. Michael Waldman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Michael, congratulations on your new book. We wanted to start by noting that although the Supreme Court is officially the Roberts Court, you say that ideologically it's the Thomas Court. Can you please explain?
Well, John Roberts, we assign his name to the court as a matter of historical convenience, and he holds the gavel. But in a lot of significant ways, Clarence Thomas holds the power and has the influence. There's now a 6-vote supermajority of the 9 of very conservative justices, by and large working in lockstep. And Thomas's approach, which is not to pay much attention to precedent, to claim that he's only following originalism, to disdain the impact and public reaction to rulings, has been what has dominated the most significant rulings of the past year and probably more to come.
Michael, why do you refer to the court's last term as radical? Could you cite some examples of some of the right-wing court's most egregious rulings recently?
The supermajority, this group of justices, this faction of a faction that now has the power in this court, their first full year ended in June 2022. And in the last 3 days of the term, they put forward 3 rulings that were really radical in different ways and really significant with huge potential impact on millions of people's lives. The first was the Bruin case, which was by far the most sweeping Second Amendment ruling in the country's history, sort of not even a close call, that basically said that courts cannot consider public safety when they're looking at gun rules, only, quote, history and tradition, what was done back in the founding era. The next day was the Dobbs ruling. This overturned Roe v. Wade, as your listeners no doubt know, and ended the half a century of protection of abortion rights in the federal Constitution and put all the other privacy rights at risk, too. And the day after that, the last day of the term, was a case that didn't get as much attention called West Virginia versus EPA. And this was the opening salvo on what is clearly going to be a really major effort to curb the power of the federal government to act to protect the environment, public safety, and these kinds of regulatory matters. They crammed decades of social change into those 3 days. And, you know, the law didn't change, the facts didn't change. What changed was the personnel on the court, and the consequences are pretty visible to all of us.
In its recent decision in Glacier Northwest v. Teamsters, as you know, the court weakened the right to strike. And you just referred to this, but do you think the court will further erode the authority of administrative agencies to regulate labor, health, safety, and the environment? And what might that look like?
I think very much so. In the early part of the 20th century, the ideological Supreme Court of that era saw its role as being stopping government from acting to protect women, to protect public safety and workers and the like. And this, among other things, led to the big conflict with Franklin Roosevelt and the court packing fight. But one of the things that happened in 1937 is that the conservative justices of that day backed down. They said they were not going to try to limit the general ability of the federal government to regulate the economy nationwide. A lot of libertarians, a lot of business interests have thought, oh, that was a bad thing that happened, and have tried to come up with some way to persuade earlier generations of Supreme Courts to cut back on the power of the federal government, unsuccessfully until last June. Last June, the court said, first of all, that a regulatory agency, in that case it was the EPA, could not act even if Congress had passed legislation with language, in effect giving it the power to act. They could not act if it was a, quote, major question. Meaning if it was important enough, Congress had to do it, the regulators could not. Now the Supreme Court has taken a case where they're going to, in the next term, consider something called the Chevron Doctrine, which is basically a rule that conservatives on the court over many years pushed that gives the experts in regulatory agencies basically the first say on what an ambiguous law passed by Congress means, that judges are not going to second guess these experts on these technical matters. And these cases and the more cases that are coming suggest pretty strongly that when it comes to big, visible, high-profile issues like abortion or guns, that's one thing. But these are the cases that are very technical, that don't get as much attention, but that mean a lot of money to a lot of people, and they're going to work hard, it seems, to impose a particular ideological view of what the role and shape and size of the federal government ought to be by claiming that they're doing it based on constitutional rulings. So I think this is going to be a big, big part of the story going forward.
Michael, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito favor the deconstruction of the administrative state. Could you explain for our listeners what that is, and why do conservatives eschew regulation?
Well, the administrative state is part of our modern way of life, part of our modern government. It's the idea that there are some issues that are quite technical and where you can't expect judges or even legislators to have all the details and understand all the science and understand all the changes that go on. So when Congress over many decades created these agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which polices fraud on Wall Street, or other agencies like that, Congress gave the agencies a lot of authority to decide what to do. And they have procedures, you have to have public hearings, there's all kinds of rules about how these agencies act. But that's how we have safe cars. That's how we have safe drinking water. That's how we have workplace safety or the ability to organize a union or all these other things that are protected by these administrative agencies. They call it the administrative state. Now, why do Gorsuch and Thomas and Alito not like this? Well, they say, oh, it's because it takes away the power from the elected officials who should be making these decisions, the democratically accountable officials. And of course, those officials voted to give this power to these expert agencies. I think that more broadly, the legal conservative movement isn't as focused on who has the power, but that the government should not intrude in the marketplace. They do not want the kind of regulation of environmental protection that these agencies sometimes put forward. They don't want the policing of Wall Street and so on. It's the same fight you see in Congress. It's the same fight you see in other realms. Now it's playing out in the courts, and they're trying to find a constitutional argument with these very conservative justices in there. And Gorsuch and Thomas and Alito in different ways, but especially Gorsuch and especially Thomas, have basically said that they think that the rulings in the 1930s that allowed the federal government to create a national modern economy were really wrong. As I write in the book, The Supermajority, that in Gorsuch's case, this is pretty interesting because it's actually carrying on a family crusade. His mother, Ann Gorsuch, was a very well-known sort of flamboyant figure in the 1980s. She was the second highest-ranking woman in the Reagan administration. She was the head of the EPA, and she was very charismatic. She was very close to industry. She put people from the industry in charge of the EPA. It was nonstop scandal, nonstop controversy. She eventually was held in contempt of Congress and forced out of her job. And in her memoir at the time, she talks about her teenage son, Neil, saying, well, you know, Mom, you didn't raise me to be a quitter. Why are you being a quitter? But basically, the liberals getting his mom driven out of Washington was the childhood trauma for Neil Gorsuch. We all have our traumas. That was his. Of course, it's a little less dramatic what he's doing, but in a sense, it's the same goal of curbing the power of government to regulate business.
So fascinating. Michael, you also wrote a book in 2016, The Fight to Vote, on the long struggle to secure the right to vote for all Americans. With the case of Merrill v. Milligan, concerning Alabama's redrawn congressional maps, now pending before the court, what's your prediction about future protections for voting rights? And we know the Brennan Center follows this closely.
Well, over the years, the Supreme Court and the federal courts even were never the main place where voting rights victories happened and where voting rights protection was implemented. Far more of the strong protection of voting rights came from things like the Voting Rights Act, which was passed by Congress, signed into law by a president, and won with the blood and courage and sacrifice of demonstrators like John Lewis and the others in Selma in 1965. Over the course of history, there just have not been so many, you know, rock'em sock'em big, you know, transformative wins for voting rights at the Supreme Court. What's been different in the past decade and a half, and this is something where John Roberts has led the way. He may not be as conservative, say, as Clarence Thomas, but on the issues of democracy, he's just as much of an activist and just as pointed, I would argue, in the wrong direction. The Supreme Court has, in a series of rulings, gone out of its way to demolish the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was the most effective civil rights law in many ways on the books. And in 2013, in the Shelby County case, they basically rendered inoperative the key part of that law, which was that states with a history of discrimination in voting needed to get permission from the Justice Department or a federal court to change voting rules. That was called Section 5. But there was something else called Section 2 that wasn't as good, but you could sue after the fact to challenge discriminatory voting laws. 2 years ago, in a case called Brnovich, they basically said, no, you can't really use that very easily to challenge voter suppression, to challenge the newfangled types of voting laws, so many of them coming out of the big lie, out of Trump's argument that the election was stolen and that sort of thing. Merrill v. Milligan, it's actually the name of the case has changed, but it's the same case, looks at Section 2 and the use that Section 2 has had for decades, which is to stop gerrymandering on racial grounds, stop drawing of district lines in a way that dilutes the political power and effective vote for black people and other communities of color and minority communities. There is, at the moment we are talking, we don't know what the outcome will be, but based on the lineup of the court, based on the fact that John Roberts has a bee in his bonnet about the Voting Rights Act, I am not optimistic that there's going to be much left of the law when this court is done.
Very, very disturbing indeed, Michael. Why do you think liberals have largely fallen silent in challenging the court's shift to the radical right?
I think that's changing, but I think you're right that that has been too much of the case, too much of the time. Until quite recently, public approval in the polls of the Supreme Court was much higher for Democrats and liberals than for conservatives and Republicans, despite Shelby County, despite Citizens United, and so many of these other rulings. Some of that, I think, is the long afterglow of the Warren Court, which was the one time in the court's history, one time in the country's history, that the court has been was ahead of the country, and was in some ways too aggressive in being ahead of the country as opposed to being a reactionary force. And we are still living in that backlash. For a long time, conservatives organized, conservatives criticized the court. They made sure their candidates would pledge to focus on the Supreme Court, and Democrats and liberals, progressives did not. I think that is changing. I mean, I think in the aftermath of Dobbs especially, we've seen a significant backlash, a significant electoral consequence of this court's radicalism. And I think that that's going to change, but I think it has to change. I think that, you know, even President Biden, he has been pretty strong, actually, about appointing judges and actually getting judges onto the bench. But he has not spoken out about the court, not used his bully pulpit, and I think that's a mistake.
Michael, some critics propose packing the court with more liberal jurists. Why do you think this is unlikely to happen, and what are its drawbacks?
So it's certainly constitutional. It's certainly legal. Congress has expanded and contracted the size of the court before. A lot of people don't realize that. They kind of assume that 9 is in the Constitution. Is it a good idea? The idea of expanding the court, you know, in that way certainly comes, for example, after the what a lot of us regard as a stolen seat when Mitch McConnell and the Republicans simply refused to even consider President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland for a full year, raw politics, just because they could. The worries about court expansion include that it would be instantly turning into a retaliatory spiral where the Democrats add 5 and then the Republicans add 5, but also that there's a risk that it would look illegitimate to a lot of people who actually are appalled by the court. Franklin Roosevelt, you know, when he proposed that, it was defeated. And it was in the middle of the Great Depression. They had just struck down the first New Deal. They were getting ready to rule on Social Security and on the labor laws and other really popular big things. Roosevelt had just won the biggest electoral victory ever up until that point, and he had 70% of the Senate in his own party, and even he found that the pushback, which was unexpected from a sort of an invisible majority, was too intense. The court backed down as well, but Roosevelt's political coalition was shattered by it. So those are the downsides. The upside is that if the court continues in the reckless and extreme direction that it's in now, I think there'll be more people calling for it. I really believe that the best answer is to impose an 18-year term limit on Supreme Court justices. That is the idea that no person should have too much power for too long. It is pretty much reflective of the insight that George Washington had when he was president, that he stepped down after two terms. And it's an interesting thing. It's very popular with Democrats and Republicans. You know, every state Supreme Court but one, for example, has either term limits or an age, a retirement age. So do the constitutional courts in other countries. I was a member of a presidential commission on the U.S. Supreme Court that President Biden appointed in 2021. And these commissions, you know, they're sort of notorious for not doing much of anything. And we were actually instructed before we gathered not to reach conclusions. It actually was in the public instructions to the commission. And we didn't. It was a government agency that worked, finally, as intended. But something really interesting happened. We heard from dozens of public witnesses from left and right. And they disagreed on a lot of things. Some people wanted court expansion, others didn't. Some people wanted a code of ethics, others didn't. One after another, though, they said, oh, but I support term limits. There's actually, when you look at who supports it, when you look at public opinion, there's a broad public support for term limits, for making it so that each president can make a nomination every 2 years, which I hope would drain the poison to some degree out of the nominations process. Now, how could you do it? You certainly could do it with a constitutional amendment. I think you could do it as well through a statute. The Supreme Court in the past has upheld things like that. So I think it's going to happen. I think that I'm not under any illusion that, you know, as wide as the support is right now, if it ever gets to that point, undoubtedly there'll be more polarization. But I think it can be done in a way that wins broad support.
Michael, as we head toward 2024, how do you think the Supreme Court's right-wing overreaching will impact the election?
You know, history offers a bit of a lesson here. I think it'll have a big impact. In the country's history, when there's been a period of overreach, there's been a backlash. When the court has been, usually the Supreme Court kind of hugs the middle. It kind of reflects the political consensus. But when it's been unduly partisan or extreme or unduly activist, there's a significant response, organizing, agitation, even electoral realignment. And we're seeing a very significant response to this Supreme Court already. In the 2022 midterm elections, usually those go really badly for whoever the party is that controls the White House. The Democrats this time had the best midterm election in decades. And that was a response to Dobbs, to the Dobbs ruling, and to fears for democracy, all kind of conflated to in a lot of people's mind as worrying about extremism. Even more striking to me was the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election in April, where, you know, Wisconsin's kind of a very evenly divided state. The electorate is evenly divided. And usually these races are very close. And it turned into an 11-point win for the more liberal candidate. And it was a referendum, basically, on the direction of the courts and on Dobbs and on abortion rights. And, you know, political scientists will tell you that's kind of an earthquake. You don't get that big a shift. So I think it's going to be a big issue in 2024. I think it won't just be on the Republican side, which has often been the way it's been up until now, but on the Democratic side as well. And I don't know how it will play out, of course, but I think that this is now going to be a central political debate going forward, as it should be.
Michael, in our last 2 minutes, you write the conservatives know that the best way to correct overreach is through public pressure. How do you recommend that progressives and liberals do that?
By talking about it, by voting about it, by demanding that candidates tell them what kind of justices they're going to appoint and how much pressure, how much priority, rather, they're going to place on this, just the way the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation and conservatives have done for years and years. We can push back with constitutional amendments. We can push back by encouraging Congress to act. For example, Congress has the power to restore the strength of the Voting Rights Act because it was an interpretation of a statute and the legislation that passed the House of Representatives and had a majority support in the Senate, the Freedom to Vote John Lewis Act last year, came achingly close to enactment that way. But they couldn't overcome a filibuster, even though they had a majority of the Senate. The Senate needs to end the filibuster for those kinds of bills so you can have action. People need to march. People need to vote. People need to speak out. Conservatives understood, and liberals maybe once again are learning, the court that matters, the court where you really can win meaningful change, is the court of public opinion. It turns out that the most important words in the dense text of the Constitution are the first three, we the people.
Well, as we wrap up here, Michael, how can our listeners follow your work and that of the Brennan Center?
Well, I hope folks will read The Supermajority. It's important, I think, that those arguments about the court get a wide audience. We also, at the Brennan Center, have content-rich newsletters, electronic newsletters, one that I write every week called The Briefing, comes out on a Tuesday. No spam, lots of nutrition. You can go to brennancenter.org/briefing. You can sign up. But if you go to the Brennan Center website, brennancenter.org, you can sign up for our newsletters and find out our work on a very regular basis.
Michael, thank you so much for this really important book, The Supermajority. We hope our listeners will read it. And thank you for the great work that the Brennan Center has done over the years.
Tremendous. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Restrictions began after the New York Civil Liberties Union looked into several cases of people who were harassed, detained, and arrested by federal agents while photographing or shooting video of federal buildings from the vantage points of public plazas and sidewalks. In 2010, the New York Civil Liberties Union brought a suit against the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in federal court, challenging its practice of arresting photographers. In October of that year, a settlement was reached in which the U.S. government agreed that no federal statutes or regulations bar people from photographing the exterior of federal buildings, and the government issued a directive to members of the Federal Protective Service on photographers' rights. A decade later, these rights are being put to the test in a practice known by some as First Amendment audit. We're joined by one such First Amendment auditor whose popular YouTube channel is called Big Nick South Florida Accountability. With view counts in the millions, Nicholas Freeman joins us to talk about his work in Fort Lauderdale, where he's part of an emerging trend to educate local law enforcement about the public's right to photography. Nick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored and I appreciate it so much.
Nick, tell our listeners about your community in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and why you decided to become a First Amendment auditor.
Okay. Like many African Americans in America, I grew up in an impoverished part of my community. Even though my background was low middle class to middle class, you know, eventually I did wind up bleeding over into the lesser impoverished areas. But what led me to become to actually pick up a camera and started doing what I do was a couple of years ago, Stephon Clark was in the news. That was a young man, I believe, in Washington that was shot by the cops in his grandmother's backyard by holding up his cell phone. Now, I had always been a little upset about the treatment that my community were receiving from those that were sworn to serve and protect. I just didn't know how to express it, how to deal with it, how to fight back, until I came across the Stephon Clark story. And I was just, to be honest with you, I was just really, really upset. And I wanted to go on YouTube, and I just wanted to find black people running away from cops and getting away, you know, like making cops run after them and they couldn't catch them and getting away. And I stumbled across some channels that was doing exactly what I'm doing. And I started watching them and I started being intrigued by them and really felt drawn to it. And one day I just decided, you know what, the police department is a couple of blocks away. Let me just grab my camera, go out and just see the response that I would get. And the response was exactly what I thought it would be, and it just opened up a whole can of worms for them.
I've heard the phrase, eyes don't trespass. What does that mean when auditors use that?
Meaning, as long as I'm on somewhere I'm supposed to be, you cannot stop me from looking at anything as long as I'm in public. You can't make me turn my head. You can't make me walk in another direction. I can see anything that my eyes will focus on. So you can't trespass my eyes, even if it's on private property. If it's visible from the public's view, I'm allowed to look at it.
Nick, walk us through, if you will, a typical confrontation with a police officer who asks to see your identification, even though you're filming in a public area.
Okay. Well, the first thing we do, that's an intimidation tactic for them to let you know that they have authority and power. So the first thing they would do is they'd come up and ask you, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? And of course, you know, if you don't feel like answering them, you don't have to answer them because you do have the Fifth Amendment right in this country. So if you don't want to answer them, the next step would be, well, do you have any ID? And that's always an intimidation tactic. So once they ask for ID, me being knowledgeable in my state penal code for presenting ID, always remind them that, you know, in Florida, unless I'm suspected of committing a crime, I'm about to commit a crime, or I'm in the process of committing a crime, I have absolutely no obligation or duty to present any type of information to you. And besides that, we have the Fourth Amendment right in America where, you know, we're to be secure in our papers and effects.
Do you get the line from police officers specifically that you're engaging in, quote, suspicious activity? And how do you respond to that?
All the time. Suspicious activity is just a way for them to curtail around the Fourth Amendment. And my response to that would be a suspicion of misdemeanor or felony.
What response do you get from police officers? Does that get them angrier or do they specifically answer you?
They specifically answer me, but you can still tell they're dumbfounded because the answer is always, well, it's neither. And once they acknowledge that it's neither, and then the law shields me, and they can see the shield coming completely around me. Because if I'm not breaking the law and you're a law enforcer, you have absolutely no purpose at this point.
Nick, do you ever get a response from civilians who may be sometimes upset that they're included in whatever you are photographing or videoing? And what do you say to them?
Once I let them know that, you know, I'm not here to record them, that I'm only here to record public officials and their interactions with the public, if that doesn't work, then I would try to let them know that there's no expectation of privacy in public, meaning if you're out in public, you know what, my eyes can't trespass, I can look at you, I can record you. If that doesn't work, then I would typically point out the many, many, many cameras that is in the area, buildings, in a particular location. And I would try to let them know that statistics show they walk under no less than 3,000 cameras per day.
And you're talking about surveillance cameras that are literally everywhere we may walk.
Absolutely. And I would ask you a question. When you walk into a building or you walk past a building, does those people ask your permission to record you?
No, they don't. Very good point. I'm curious, have you ever been roughed up by the police, or have they ever tried to take away your camera from you?
I have not been roughed up, knock on wood, but I have been arrested 6 times for my activism. I have 6 acquittals because I don't cop out. I take it to trial each time. I've had my equipment taken all 6 times, and the longest it's been taken has been about 6 months. I've literally spent thousands of dollars to replace equipment that has been held in evidence.
I would imagine that you are a familiar face to many law enforcement officers. Do you think that many of them know who you are?
I would say 100% of them know who I am. Even the agencies in South Florida that I hadn't visited, when I did visit, they already was aware as to who I am and what it is that I do. And, you know, it is a blessing and a curse now, because the blessing is that now that they understand who I am and what I do, that I'm allowed to do something that I have the right to do, if that makes sense. They now allow me to do something that I've always had the right to do without any type of confrontation or harassment. However, to me, they're putting their best foot forward because it's me. But I still get information from, you know, the public that, hey, these cops are doing this, these cops are doing that. And I wonder if they're doing it because they know I'm not around. So to me, it's like it's a double-edged sword to me.
Nick, can you tell listeners about the Department of Homeland Security case where plaintiff Antonio Musumeci was arrested in November 2009 after recording with a handheld video camera a protester in a public plaza outside the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Federal Courthouse in Manhattan?
Yes. That case was a very interesting case to me because it did set, well, it didn't even set precedent. It just reaffirmed that was already American right to do so, to be a member of the free press, which means you're allowed to go out and you're allowed to observe, you're allowed to redress your government and peacefully protest in the manner that you see fit. However, once that happened, the Department of Homeland Security, the Federal Protective Services, put out a memo that auditors such as myself now routinely refer to. You would see it in your local post office. You would see it in your federal courthouses. We refer to it as Poster 7, where the Department of Homeland Security made it an edict to put it in each and every one of the federal locations. That is open to the public, that public photography for news purposes can be taken in hallways, foyers, courtyards, anywhere that the public is permitted. So by him being arrested, basically he did what auditors are doing now, is telling these law enforcement officers or agencies to know your job that you're doing. You took an oath to the Constitution. Don't just take the oath, read the Constitution. Read your memos, understand your briefings. You know, follow up on your information that you're receiving so you can better protect the public.
Why is it important to document the different types of reactions that you may get from law enforcement officers during a First Amendment audit?
Well, they make up laws. They make up laws that you're invading privacy, or you need my permission to record my image, that this is county property, without understanding that county property is public property because there's no person named county. The people make up the county. The public makes up the county. So they see things like this is public property, or I mean, this is county property, this is the sheriff's office department property. You can't record in the courthouse lobby. With the rules states you can't record in the courtrooms. It's a lot of wordplay. If you're not familiar with what they're doing, you will allow them to dominate and dictate your actions, and, you know, that defeats the purpose of what you're doing.
I understand that sometimes federal employees who work in these buildings, their reaction may be even worse sometimes than law enforcement reaction. Can you give us an example of that? And is this an important learning lesson for those employees?
It is absolutely important learning lesson for those employees, because even though they're not the enforcement part of the government, they're the representatives of the government. They're the direct link from the public to the government itself. And those are the people who should be the most knowledgeable of the things that the public should be able to have access to when it comes to a public place, a public building, public ownership of this said establishment. Say, for instance, the post office, the postal service. That is one of the most public places in America. You know, it's open to each and every individual who's in America. And these people should know that this poster that is completely displayed, prominently displayed on their poster board, allows people like myself to come in and observe them in their work or place of work, to see where my tax dollars are going to make sure that I am being represented in any way that I should be, but they're completely unaware. I like to refer to people like that as three categories of people like that. You have the one that really want to serve the public. You have the people that want to assert authority. And you have the people that want paychecks and pensions. And the paychecks and pensions are 70% of the problem. That's all they come to work for, a paycheck and pension. They don't care about the public. They don't care about community service. The only thing they want to do is come clock in, clock out, and after 20 years, live off the tax dollars for the rest of their lives.
I understand that you have a category called tyrant alert. Can you talk about some of the kinds of physical abuse police or even others engage in during First Amendment audits?
Yes. Well, the biggest problem is the threat of arrest. We consider that in the auditing community a threat of violence, because if you're going to arrest me, that means you're going to grab me, you're going to place me in shackles, you're going to move me against my will. To me and to other auditors, that's violence. That's violence against me. Plus, you're heavily armed. You have a death belt, what we refer to. And at any point, my life is in your hand, and you can decide whether I live or die. So, you know, they would grab you. They would illegally detain you. They would, try to force you to sit on the ground, to stop talking, to try to tell you exactly how the situation is going to play out, which it should be the other way around. The analogy I like to use is law enforcement or government work is the only employment in America where the employee treats the employer as the lesser of the two. See, I always refer to the term public servant. And the most prevalent line of that public servant is the servant part. Every servant has a master. Maybe harsh to say, but they're the ones who label themselves public servants. So which makes the public the masters. But it's the only occupation in America where the servant dictates to the master.
Yes, and where the servant is empowered to use force, including lethal force.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go to a local restaurant, say, you know, fast food chain, and the employee talks to the manager in that manner, the first thing the manager would do was clock out and go home. Mm. You know, but in public, we can't tell law enforcement to clock out and go home. You're no longer needed. You know, they have one of the strongest unions in America, you know, and they do everything they can to keep these people in power. So a tyrant is someone who goes above and beyond his call of duty just to enforce his will on you.
Nick, what is the walk of shame?
The walk of shame is when they come up with their chest all puffed out, breathing fire out of their noses, and the law hits them right in the face, and they turn around, and they have to walk away without doing anything that they originally set out to accomplish.
Tell us about the positive effects that First Amendment audits have done to improve police relations in your community.
Well, it has empowered the public with knowledge to understand that I'm not just I can speak from my point of view. I am very proud to be who I am. I'm very proud to be an African-American in America. I served my country proudly, 6 years in the military. But being a citizen of America has gotten everything. So what First Amendment auditors have done is enlighten people to understand that their citizenship vastly outweighs their race. And once they take advantage and understand the power that they have in being a citizen of the United States, that, you know, they are the ones that are called the shot. They're the ones that protect their community. They're the ones that take these ill-informed people who we entrust with our public safety. I know myself personally, I have touched millions of people. I get messages all the time about how my information has saved them, how they're going to be more knowledgeable and then find the knowledge to do what I do. So it's the information that they're receiving from me that lets me know that I am making a difference.
You have inspired many others to begin launching their own auditing channels on YouTube. What advice do you have for others who want to follow in your footsteps, Nick?
To be themselves and also to stand firm, to be willing to take that ride. You know, I tell people all the time, a lot of problems that Americans have is that we have gotten to the point where if it don't affect me, I'm going to stay out of it. But I'm willing to take that ride so you don't have to take that ride. So you have to stand firm. You have to stand pat. You have to know what you're doing is for the greater good and that it's bigger than you. That's the first thing I had to do was understand that what I am doing is bigger than me. When I first became popular and I was getting all these accolades and people was contacting me, it went to my head. I almost had celebrity status. But because of my upbringing and the people that I have in my life, I quickly humbled myself to realize that what I'm doing is really affecting other people, and this is now bigger than I am. So the advice I would give people is to stand firm, be strong, and be willing to be a martyr so the person next to you don't have to be one.
Nick, we're going to play one or two video compilations made from your encounters. So we're going to pause to listen to a few minutes from one right now.
Okay.
What's your name and your badge number?
Officer Pitt,
3199. Thank you.
Hey,
what's your name and your badge number?
Hold on. What's your name, sir? What is your name?
What crime are you suspecting me to commit?
Well, they want to trespass warn you, which they have the right to do
right.
So they're trained.
So I don't need to get my name.
I'm
for
trying to
warn.
Talk to you.
All right.
First of all, what
I don't
want
to talk, though.
They need your
what's
identification.
What's your name? No.
They put a form. Yes, they do.
No, their name is? No.
They put a form. Yes, they do. They put a form. Yes, they do.
No,
by
they
law.
Told me to leave. I left. By law.
By
I left.
By
if
law,
you can warn me.
I need your information to put in my system.
No, I'm not. What crime do you expect me to commit?
Trespassing. And I'm asking for your information so I can write into
what
my
crime?
System.
I articulated a crime.
The train station.
Okay, they told me to leave,
sir,
and I left. So what crime did I commit? Absolutely not. 901.151 stays different.
Give me your name.
Florida Penal Code stays different.
I'm asking for your name.
Okay.
Name and date of birth, sir.
I'm not giving you my name.
What is your name and date of birth?
What's your name and your badge number?
Don't give it, sir.
You have to.
No, I can get you mine.
You're
I'm the primary, sir. I'm the primary.
Okay, so why are they here?
Because they're my backup.
Okay,
and I'm
I need
primary.
Their name.
My
in case
no.
You violate my rights, I need
well,
to know
I'm
who to contact.
I'm asking for their form.
And I'm not giving
it's
it.
Sergeant
they asked me to leave. They asked me to leave, and I left. Okay,
all.
So you don't need my information.
Do.
So you don't need, no,
do.
I'm not giving them my information. Florida Penal Code 901.
See this?
Florida Penal Code says that I don't care.
State that you need to provide them.
First, you need to warn me what you're doing now, and I'm not on it.
I have nothing to do with
good.
That.
Good. So I'm not, you can't force
I
me
can
to give them.
Hold on, let me talk.
You can't force me to give my ID without breaking the law.
Well, when the police officer asks for identification,
that's not what Florida Penal Code 901.151 states.
Yes.
It states suspicion
sir.
Of a crime, about to commit a crime, or have committed a crime.
You can hold your phone.
Am I being detained?
Well, right now, yes, you are.
For what crime?
For trespassing.
Okay.
You're
in a trespassing
investigation.
I'm not a trespassing. I'm talking to you.
Okay.
I need the sergeant, please.
Sergeant's coming, sir.
Thank you. And so you told them not to identify to a citizen, right?
No.
You told
you're
them
dealing
not,
with me. I'm the primary.
But they're here.
No,
they're
they
here.
Have nothing to do with it.
They're
they
here.
Responded to
first of all, why
are
you so loud? Back up a little
I'm
bit.
I'm right here.
Okay, but back up a little bit.
Because you're right next to me.
No, you
and
walked up to me.
All,
okay, I'm going
to
step a step back. I'm
going
to take a step back. Now, am I being detained?
Yes, you're still being detained for questions.
What took place on the train?
And since I'm being detained, then at this point I like to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
My God.
I like to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Oh my God. What took place on the train that they didn't want to trespass on you? That's what we're asking.
I don't know. Investigate them.
I did. I talked to her. But okay. I want your side of the story.
I don't have a side.
There's two sides of the story, right?
I don't have a side. I don't answer questions, buddy.
You don't answer questions?
No.
Okay, but you have to provide ID. And
no, I don't.
For an investigation, yes, you do.
Suspicion of a crime or about to commit a crime, how I committed a crime.
What
is 901.151.
I know what it is,
sir. I'm an activist.
I know.
And you know I don't have to give you my information.
I see.
You know I don't have to give you my information. So all that, when a police...
First of all, you have your name for the form for them.
No, I don't. Because, no, they asked me to leave and I left. I know the law. I'm very well versed in the law.
Okay.
They told me to leave and I left.
Okay.
So that's my
very
warning. I'm very versed in the law.
They want to put you in a system, so when we have to deal with you again, if we do, it's already there, sir.
Then that's when you get it. If I break the law, that's when you get it.
No, we put it now, so...
No, I don't like giving my name to the government for nothing.
How do you get checked? For paid, stuff like that,
I
right?
said for it's nothing. Not,
for nothing, but for anything, right? So
I don't like giving my information to the government for just randomly.
Stop yelling at me.
I'm not... I can yell. I can talk.
Stop
freedom
yelling.
Of speech.
I'm asking you to stop yelling at me.
Do you feel threatened?
I kind of do.
Okay, then you can go.
I can't go, honestly.
You can go.
Believe me, I wish I could.
Okay.
Talk to him. Sir, this guy does this all the time.
I shake your hand, Sergeant.
I know.
So you're not going to shake my hand, Sergeant? You're not going to shake? Hanson, what's your badge number, Hanson?
3065.
Thank you.
Hanson,
3065. Let your dog know.
I'm not a dog, number one.
Let your dog know.
I'm not a dog,
that he can't attack me.
You
look at it.
I'm not a dog.
Hey, back off from attacking law-abiding law citizen.
I'm an officer.
Do not intimidate a law. You're not acting like a law. You're not acting like an officer. No, you're trying to demand me to give my information to them.
They need it for their report.
I don't care, and I'm telling you, you're trying to... That's not true, Sergeant. You hear what he's saying, Sergeant? When an officer asks me my name, I have to give it to him.
If you're being detained, you are. Yes.
No, I have to be legally detained.
But you do this so often, we actually don't.
I have to be lawfully detained.
I'll give it to the system. Have a nice day.
Lawfully detained.
Stay out of my face.
I'm not in your face. You just came right here.
Stay out of my face.
Look, see how your feet moving, kick rock.
Nick, how can our listeners follow your work?
Well, you can follow me on YouTube. It's Big Nick. South Florida Accountability. That's on YouTube. And on Instagram, it's all together, is Big Nick South Florida. And on YouTube is my surname, Nick Freeman.
Nick Freeman on Facebook. Nick, it's really been a pleasure to spend a few minutes with you. We want to thank you for the critically important work that you do and wish you the best in safety as you're out on the streets exercising your First Amendment rights. Thank you so much.
I thank you so much for having me. And with a parting shot, if I can just have your listeners to remember, always record your interactions with the government.
Words to the wise. Nick, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Be safe.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Welcome to the TaxCast, a Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. You can subscribe to the TaxCast there, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Let me know what you think of the show. Okay, coming up later on the TaxCast, the state of Minnesota in the United States nearly took a historic step for tax justice this month, but the lobbyists won, for now.
If you're a Big Four accounting firm or one of the major law firms that support multinational companies in their tax abuse, this is guaranteed to freak you out. What you want is to make sure that nobody ever tries it, that they feel the threat, the pressure, before they get to that decision point and they don't go ahead. You tell them everything will go wrong for you. You tell them anything.
Ah, it was so close. We're going to talk about that later. But first, the threats from monopoly power. A world where dominant multinationals get to run the world isn't a very happy place, or a very secure one, as it turns out. For such a long time, governments have been absent from taking the threat seriously and dealing with it. In the United States, what they call the antitrust movement has a long history. The Biden administration has actually been much more active in protecting people and the economy, more than any administration in decades, actually. There's a very long way to go, obviously. But everywhere, really, the threats posed to us all from monopolies just aren't that well understood. Some of the effects on our lives aren't that obvious, and really it's more accurate to call it concentrated market power, because we're talking about saturation by only a handful of companies in each sector. So what does that look like? Well, according to one estimate, we've got a problem when only four companies are getting 40% of sales. That's a market that's distorted and it's lost its competitive character.
The increasing build-up of corporate power, the increasing concentration of corporate power over lots of different bits of our economy over many years is actually the central feature of our economic system.
This is Nick Dearden of Global Justice Now.
The four corporations have cornered the entire global market in grain. They effectively decide what gets grown and how. They decide what food we buy and at what price. They decide what we eat and indeed who doesn't eat. And you can apply that logic across the whole economy.
It sounds a bit simplistic to say this, but it seems like we have only one value, and that's the sacred right to make a profit no matter who gets hurt or killed. The climate crisis and lack of proper action is an obvious example.
Yes, you know, it's endangering our very existence on this planet. And if we're honest, you know, big business does not operate in any kind of a free market whatsoever.
It's often hard to see the era you're living through when you're in it. But we've been living through a neoliberal era for a very long time. But now it's beginning to crumble. Here's journalist Nick Shackson, formerly of the Tax Justice Network and now with the excellent Balanced Economy Project. He's speaking here at Yale University. And he's describing here the kind of waking up with a hangover from the big party the night before.
The new idea was that we should stop worrying about democracy. We should stop worrying about power. We should stop worrying really about the structure of markets. And we should boil everything down, narrow everything down to consumer prices. And as long as consumers are happy, everything's great. And we should also focus on the internal efficiency of corporations. If corporations are efficient, then they're going to spread their wealth around and everything will be fine. So don't worry about these other issues. This story that was, one of the components of what many people call neoliberalism spread rapidly. It was obviously very well funded and it became the dominant narrative, and it effectively allowed for the massive consolidation that we've seen since then. Private equity firms were among the drivers of this consolidation, buying up firms all over the place and bolting them all together, but many other drivers of consolidation. And there was effectively a falling away of the state. The state decided to stand back, and this was both under Republicans and Democrats, all the way up to the Trump administration. And so you had this story that once you start picking at it, it's so obviously incoherent, so obviously wrong, but power was with it, and it survived and flourished across the world, spread across the world, spread to Europe, spread to other countries, to Australia, to Asia, to lower income countries. And so we have the giants of today, and there's pretty much no government anywhere has been effectively cracking down until very recently. So the new movement came along with this new story saying we need to start thinking about power again. We need to start thinking about democracy. We need to start thinking about the structure of markets, and we need to start taking down these giants and regulating with confidence again in the interests of people.
Yes. Obviously, the most recognised monopolies are easy to see because they clearly wield too much power, like Facebook, Amazon and Google. And not all monopolies are a bad thing. I mean, a well-run state healthcare monopoly that has the buying power to keep medical costs down and tackle pharmaceutical giants seems like an undeniably good thing. The National Health Service here in Britain is humanity at its very best. I've seen that for myself. And we used to have public-owned railways, public-owned water. Sadly, we lost those. But we can't say all state-owned monopolies are run in the public interest in the ways they should be. We've got creeping private sector involvement and sometimes the same extractive processes as any other dominant company. So our solutions must be about enshrining rights to essential things we all need, keeping them firmly in the non-profit sector. It's got to be also about democratizing ownership and control, as well as, of course, breaking up corporate power where we need to. And it's bad, very bad, in the States, despite the Biden administration being the most active for decades in tackling these big mergers. The top 1% of corporations make 81% of all sales, and they own 97% of all assets. You can check out stats like that on www.businessconcentration.com. It's pretty interesting. The biggest market players dominate our every waking hour. What we eat every day, how we travel, how we get our news and information, who we bank with. They influence what decisions our governments make, how much we pay for stuff, how much we fall short in tax revenues and the consequences of that. But if it seems like we're taking on the impossible here, we're not, as any good freedom fighter will tell you. Here's Nick Shaxson again.
I've worked with the Tax Justice Network for many years. I started not quite at the very beginning, but near the beginning, and there was just a tiny group of us, and we had some demands, some policy proposals that, you know, the powers, you know, everybody said, oh, that's utopian nonsense. Nobody's ever going to do that. And all of those proposals are now, to one degree or another, with many gaps, obviously, but have been accepted as mainstream policy by governments around the world. I've seen from the inside of a movement having, you know, some significant success. And, you know, we made a lot of progress, not as far as much as we want, but I mean, the whole international tax justice movement, we did achieve a lot.
That's Nick Shaxson there speaking at a recent event held by Global Justice Now called The Threat of Monopoly Capitalism. And you can't really separate monopoly power and market concentration from tax havenry and corporate secrecy. All of them have happened because we've allowed huge imbalances of power across our economies. And just like tax havens and the companies who use them, it's the same. It's all about escape, escaping things they don't like, whether it's taxes other small businesses pay, regulations, laws, accountability when things go wrong, transparency about how they operate or which politicians they're funding. Here's Nick Shaxson again.
One of the things that I think is very important is that monopoly, it's like privatization. It's a form of privatization in a way, privatization of regulation, because if you get a bunch of companies together and they form a cartel, their bosses collude to rig prices or rig wages or whatever, that is subject to public regulation. That cartel, there's anti-cartel laws and rules around the world, and they can be stopped, they can be fined, they can be punished for that with public state regulation. But the alternative, and that's what all the companies have been doing instead, is just merging. They just join together. And once they're merged together, it's like a reinforced, legalized version of a cartel. And the public regulation has been pushed out. So we are seeing monopolization as a kind of privatization of regulation.
Underlying the neoliberal era and globalization was always the philosophy that markets will answer our needs and solve our problems. The pursuit of what's the cheapest, with no other consideration, the state's job is to get out of the way. But we're finding out why that philosophy is so dangerous, and why markets left to their own devices can do the opposite of solving our problems. Here's Nick Bearden again.
You can take a number of different sectors and look at it and see the problems. But what was really interesting to me about the pharmaceutical example was the more I started looking into it, these pharmaceutical corporations like to say, we need these monopolies because otherwise we'd have no incentives to provide the medicines that society desperately needs. And it's a complete and utter lie. Actually, the more power they have accumulated, the less creative, the less inventive they have become. It isn't simply a matter of they make some really important medicines and then they squeeze as much profit out of it as they can. That was maybe the case in the 1960s and 1970s. Today, it's not like that at all.
Yes, we've seen how big companies put their efforts into financialising every aspect of what they do, and that includes minimising their taxes. Pharmaceutical companies, just like in pretty much every sector, have merged to the point where in the United States between 1995 and 2015, 60 pharmaceutical companies merged into just 10. The number of companies producing vaccines fell from 26 in 1955 to 18 in 1980 to only 4 in 2020. Do you remember that urgent chasing of COVID vaccines by different nations? This stuff left the world at a huge disadvantage dealing with COVID, especially poorer nations.
Pharmaceutical corporations are more like hedge funds. They don't invent any of the medicines, very few of the medicines on their book. They buy out other companies that have done that research. They then sit on literal monopolies. I mean, through the intellectual property, basically only that company can make this medicine for at least 20 years. And there's all sorts of ways that they try to extend that. And they squeeze as much out of it as they possibly can because they're making so much on every single sale. If you can only sell it to a few rich countries, health systems, well, that's okay. And actually, the very value of these companies comes not really from how much they sell, but from the value of the intellectual property they hold and how much investors assume that's going to be worth in the years to come. So it's extraordinary, really, because this system is supposed to be all about, rewarding innovation. But what it's actually done is completely hollowed out these enormous corporations. And I mean, I just looked at, the amount that these corporations return to their investors through dividends and share buybacks, it way exceeds their research and development budget. Indeed, for most years, it exceeds their profit. It exceeds their net income. Because we live in a political system and an economic model which assumes that the market will provide, it assumes that these corporations have all the answers, we've eroded all of the institutions that would have allowed us to provide some counterbalance to this. And so when the pandemic struck, even though basically all of the research into those medicines had already been done by the public sector or small biotechs, at the end of the day, we couldn't actually produce them because we're still dependent on these tiny pipelines. And so we had to turn to Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca and say, take all the money you want, handed it over. Now, AstraZeneca behaved a bit differently, of course, but Pfizer and Moderna, sold hardly anything to the vast majority of the world. They just weren't interested. Absolutely shocking. And that's not just, it's not just morally wrong. It's stupid because as long as there were huge parts of the world unvaccinated, we were all at risk of a new, more virile and more deadly strain of the virus coming out and undermining the vaccines that we had. But that seemed to be as of nothing to the pharmaceutical companies because, well, if the pandemic goes on longer, there's simply more money to be made. So there's no interest. It's not only that there's no interest in equitably selling the medicines the world needs and researching the medicines that all people urgently need. There's not really any interest in researching anything other than, drugs that have marginal differences on chronic diseases, because those are the most lucrative drugs.
And even if politicians in the wealthiest countries in the world don't care about equitable access to drugs at prices that aren't taking advantage of market dominance, they should care about this.
We are faced with antimicrobial resistance. Yes, we've overused antibiotics massively, but the pharmaceutical industry hasn't researched any more of these things because there's no profit in it, essentially, because they would be second, third generation antibiotics that wouldn't be used very much for the next 15, 20 years anyway. They're not going to make anything of them. Look, you just need to nationalize parts of this industry. It is simply not fit for purpose.
When you look at the logic of governments letting the biggest companies decide on supply chains based only on the bottom line, without any thought about global security, the world we've allowed corporations to build gets riskier and riskier for all of us. This is MEP and competition lawyer Stephanie Yon-Cortan speaking in Europe at an event called How Monopoly Threatens Democracy and Security.
The pandemic highlighted the EU's long-existing structural problems related to the supply of medicines and the high dependency on third country import for certain essential and highly critical goods and materials. In the wake of pandemic, it is as if we finally found out that we were 100% dependent on third countries, such as China or India. One of the key lessons of the crisis is that there is a need to get a better grip and understanding of where Europe's current and possible future strategic dependencies lie. The notion of resilience of supply chains was already much discussed before the pandemic. In the context of ensuring availability of resources necessary for the twin transitions, green and digital, of the economy and society in Europe, it became as pertinent as ever with the crisis. Now, facing this situation, it seems clear that our competition policy plays an essential role. It's one of the tools, but key one, to increase our strategic autonomy and our industrial policy that could secure supply chain. I think we are slowly moving from a naive Europe to a pragmatic and realistic one. No choice. Now, with the Russian invasion to Ukraine, we have no choice. No choice to face our dependency to Russian gas.
In the case of Russian gas, markets and the German government didn't come out of this well either, allowed storage and pipelines to be monopolized, ignoring the obvious security threats. It ended up enhancing the dominant power of Gazprom, majority owned by Russia. It was an expensive lesson. Here's Christopher Gopal of the Global Supply Chain Center at the University of Southern California. He's speaking at the same event.
The Russia issue is huge and will cause a great deal of grief to a lot of people. But this is nothing compared to the type of impact that something over in China and Taiwan can have on us. Russia has probably 4 to 6 major leverage points by which it can disrupt supply chains, and some of them are not global. China has hundreds. Just to give you one example, and when I say people are not ready for this, when we talk about the chip industry and the chip problem, what we felt in COVID was a hiccup. If the chip from China and Taiwan are blocked from coming in for any reason, those two together own about 20 to 30% of the world's production and the high-end chips. More to the point, the impact is not just on the chip industry, $100 billion or plus. Those are the primary industries. The impact goes on to the secondary industries, defense and aerospace, automobiles, heavy trucks, industrial equipment, infrastructure, all of these things, and then cascades to things like tourism, food production, traffic lights, shipping, everything else. Something like that would have enormous impact. It could bring countries to their knees. I hate to say even worse. There could be an even worse than semiconductors, is pharmaceuticals. China produces, the numbers vary from place to place, but 90% of the antibiotics. A lot of the pharmaceutical chemicals, the APIs used in the production of pharmaceuticals, cortisone, all of these things, ascorbic acid. If that gets cut off, we have no pharmaceuticals. We have no antibiotics. Enough with the place comes down because of lack of semiconductors. The place comes down because we have no medications. Our PPEs and so on are built in those areas. A cutoff from those areas would be calamitous.
Mm. Here's MEP Stephanie Yon-Cortan again on the better competition policy Europe needs.
If the political will is there, that's another question. Let me name a few, like 4 main milestones. First, I think a paradigm shift in the objective of competition policy, the objective of competition policy, I think has moved from a single perspective of maximizing the interest of consumers to a more balanced objective, particularly with regard to taking into account Europe's industrial interest. Second is the resilience. The resilience is now mentioned clearly as an objective of competition policy. And from now on, Competition policy instruments will also have to take into account resilience issue for all supply chains. That's quite new. Third point is the announcement of a new competition framework, you know, including state aid for semiconductors. I think this is a major step forward and kind of an implicit recognition that the current framework is not adequate to address the urgency of the crisis and the importance of this dependency issue. We need to multiply this approach, I think, without waiting to be paralyzed by drug, semiconductor shortage, and think about right now. For Europe, the vaccine crisis has shown us that being excellent in research is not enough to meet our needs. We need to know how to produce. We need the right scale and vision necessary to overcome persisting industrial weaknesses.
Big challenges, much of them caused by markets and market domination by a few companies. But that sounds to me like many European governments are recognising that states can no longer just stand aside. And at the heart of all this has been misconceptions about competition. You hear that word all the time. But in the neoliberalist era, it moved from meaning businesses competing with each other on innovation and efficiency to competition between nations. So governments climbing over each other to cut labour rights, cut taxes, cut regulation, a race to the bottom. In the long run, that reduces real competition when it comes to creativity and diversity. Small and medium companies get crowded out, and governments just don't seem to know how to encourage anything else. And something as valuable as collaboration doesn't get a look in. But going back to the pandemic for a moment, despite all those troubles in, for example, sourcing PPE during the pandemic across the world, do you remember that? What's happened since then? Well, most countries have defaulted to relying blindly on markets. Christopher Gopal again.
From all my discussions with people in Europe, and they've been mainly companies, I have to add, not Europe as government or policy, we are going back to the old normal, the financialization of the supply chain, where we hit just-in-time inventory, lowest cost, assets going out. And for instance, one of the biggest companies in the US, in the world rather, has just announced that they're going back to China for cheap chips, not having learned any of the lessons.
This is about the corruption of markets, really, and this is about markets not working as they should.
Nick Saxon again.
I think the United States has been so lax for so many years that anything that Europe does looks good. Having said that, the record in Europe is appalling. Just for example, I was looking the other day at the merger statistics. I think they get about 15,000 mergers a year in Europe. And of those, maybe I think 300 or 400 get notified, you know, here's a merger, it's potentially going to cause competition concerns, you guys are going to have to look at it. If you look at the record of the mergers that are notified, which are mergers of potential concern, since 1990, 0.4% of those have been prohibited, almost nothing. They just don't block mergers. So that's a sign that there's serious trouble. Anybody who looks around in Europe will know that we have a problem with big pharma, with big agriculture, with big retail, with big tech, with the big four accounting firms, with big banks. We've got the same problems. We have social democracy here in Europe that takes off some of the hardest edges of these things, but I think that whereas social democracy in Europe has been quite effective in certain areas, such as tax policy, in terms of monopolies and excessive concentrations of power, I think Europe has basically drunk the Kool-Aid. The fines that you see, several billion dollars on the tech giants, look big. You know, once you have a number of billion in there, it makes a great newspaper headline. But again, it's almost a rounding error in the actual size of the profits that these companies are making. So Europe is especially weak in this area. It's a very nuanced picture, of course. There are things positive and things you can say about Europe, but Europe is not in a position to, at the moment, spread a beneficial Brussels effect around the world in this area. We're working with Hope to spread this new story, and over time, this is something that takes years to do, to shift things in Europe so that Europeans wake up and start to do. And I think Europeans are quite capable of waking up and doing things differently. I think there's a lot of questioning going on.
Nick Dearden again.
To prevent increasing concentration of capital is really important. And the problem is, I think competition regulators over the last 40 years have almost forgotten how to do that job. Although I am heartened by the fact that an antitrust activist was appointed to the head of the US central regulator regulation body, Lena Khan. And I'm even more heartened that she seems to be taking that job really seriously. And I mean, only this week, really interesting that they're challenging a pharma merger, a big pharma merger. It is not the only answer, but I think it is part of the answer. We're in an economy which is supposed to be all about, you know, promoting small businesses, and we hear this from government all the time, and it's just the opposite of the truth. In the sector I know best, the pharmaceutical sector, your only option, your best business model is, how can I get bought out by Pfizer? That's it. I mean, what kind of a balanced economy is that creating? None, obviously.
Yeah, quite. So what are the key things, would you say, to tackle market concentration, monopoly power?
I would argue three things. First of all, what Biden has already started to do, which is industrial strategy, which is using the power of the state procurement and so on to begin shaping the economy. The thing I want to make sure is that doesn't just become a form of corporate welfare. That doesn't just become about de-risking the kind of investment that you want. There's got to be a very clear public return. If we are putting this in, what do we expect back? And that's got to be about reshaping the way that the private sector operates. I think the second thing, obviously, is more use of alternative forms of economic unit, whether that be public sector, but also cooperatives. I mean, let's give some real competition to these behemoths and create that more balanced economy. And that's not just going to happen. That needs a framework and a plan by government. And I think third, and I know this is going to be welcome on your show, but it's financial regulation. Because the deregulation of finance is absolutely crucial to how all of this happens. I mean, two or three massive investment funds now own a significant proportion of virtually all corporations traded in London and New York. And they are driving these kind of incentives ever and ever more towards profit maximization. And that's helping this corporate concentration. It's only the big monopolies that can thrive in this kind of world. Because of financial deregulation, of course, as well, these behemoths can shift their wealth around the world and avoid taxes. Because we have such a financialized economy, as we've already talked about, you know, big pharma doesn't particularly make medicines that we need anymore. What its job is to maximize shareholder wealth. So financialization is for me the other side of the monopoly capitalism equation. And I think we cannot properly bring this kind of economy to heel and make it work in the public interest without controlling that and without regulating how capital can be used.
Yeah, yes. And tax is such a strong tool for shaping markets and encouraging things that we want to see and discouraging things that we don't want to see. This comes down to the fundamentals of the purposes of tax. I mean, there's 5 R's of tax. Everyone knows the revenue R, but the repricing one is crucial here. So pricing damaging behaviour out and incentivising activity that's beneficial to the majority of us. I'll put a link to the 5 R's in the show notes, but tax fixes, just off the top of my head, there's excess profit taxes, financial transaction taxes are an obvious one, wealth taxes, windfall taxes, taxes to address the climate crisis, the list goes on, and governments just aren't using the taxes that are available to them in the public interest. Well, thank you, Nick Dearden, for joining me on the TapsCast. He's got a book coming out, by the way, all about the pharmaceutical industry later this year. It's called Pharmanomics, How Big Pharma Destroys Global Health. I'll link to that in the show notes. So let's head to Minnesota now in the United States, because there were many eyes on Minnesota this month. We had great hopes, but there was huge scaremongering by lobbyists all because it looked like Minnesota might take a historic step in making big companies active there do worldwide combined reporting. It could have raised an estimated $600 million in extra corporate tax revenue over the next 2 years. Very sadly, the enabler professions and their arguments won the day, and the proposal was dropped from the bill. But why do they hate it so much? Here's Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network.
The idea of worldwide combined reporting sounds kind of technical and boring, but it's really powerful. What we're talking about is when US states decide the basis on which they're going to apply a formula to work out how much profit they should be allowed to tax from a given multinational, instead of looking at their share of the multinational's declared activity in the United States as a whole, they would look at their share of the multinational's activity globally. Now, what that means is, at a stroke, you put a pen through any profit shifting that the multinational is doing anywhere. And you're just looking at, you know, if 1% of your global sales and employment, let's say, is in Minnesota, if that's the formula that you're using, then 1% of the global profits will be taken as tax base by Minnesota. So you more or less switch to a complete unitary basis. You assess the profits at the unit of the multinational itself, and you give up on the arm's length principle that the OECD and before that the League of Nations have been defending for 100 years, even though it's become increasingly clear to everyone that it just doesn't work, and that profit shifting is the only result of trying to do corporate taxation on that basis. But here's the thing, because this is such a good idea, because it is simple and powerful and pretty difficult to cheat, there's enormous interest for the lobbyists in making sure it doesn't happen anywhere. Because if it happens in one place, whether that's one US state or one country, as soon as it becomes clear that it works, which, you know, I think there's a general confidence that it absolutely will, and that it raises significantly more revenue than trying to make arm's length pricing or anything else work, then the demonstration effect to everyone else is going to be enormous. Why wouldn't everyone just do the same thing? And of course, if everyone does the same thing, the effect is that there is no possibility of double taxation. If everyone says we're going to take our share of the global profit, then if that's done right, all global profit will be taxed precisely once and once only. No double taxation, but also no double non-taxation. So if you're a Big Four accounting firm or one of the major law firms that support multinational companies in their tax abuse, this is guaranteed to freak you out. What you want is to make sure that nobody ever tries it, that they feel the threat, the pressure, before they get to that decision point and they don't go ahead. You tell them you're going to lose all of your investment if you do this. Everything will go wrong for you. We will hang you out to dry. We will make an example of you as people who don't understand how to do corporate taxation. You tell them anything. You tell them you'll give them money for their political campaigns if they don't do it, whatever it is. Not that I'm accusing anyone here of corruption, I'm sure. But the point is, you are desperate to stop that first state, that first country trying this. And, you know, that's kind of what appears to have happened in Minnesota. We don't know the basis on which the lead Democrat who brought this all the way forward flipped at the last moment and just took it out completely. But we do know there was an enormous amount of lobbying, and we do know that that's what happened. So we don't know the basis of that decision. But you can be sure similar things will happen in each other case.
I bet. If Minnesota had passed this proposal to implement combined worldwide reporting, it could have shone the light not just for other US states to follow, but for other countries too. They could implement this too, couldn't they?
The G24 group of lower income countries brought forward a proposal, you know, not dissimilar to do that globally within the OECD inclusive framework process, And that was what pretty much demonstrated that the inclusive framework was not inclusive, because the framework group of countries agreed that that would be the work plan for the Secretariat. They would evaluate it and a couple of other options and then come back. And the Secretariat at the OECD never did that. They didn't do it because before they got there, the United States and France did a bilateral deal on a completely different approach. And then the Secretariat came back to the inclusive framework and said, hey, this is the way we're going to go instead. So it became immediately clear, this is back in 2019, that the inclusive framework was a sham. There was no inclusivity for non-OECD members, and that that type of option, even though the OECD had promised to the world to go beyond the arm's length principle in that process, they didn't mean going that far beyond, just a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit, as they're now trying in Pillar 1. And that's why the OECD process, of course, isn't going to really change the world, because they gave up on the original ambition. And again, we'll never quite be sure how much that's the result of very intense lobbying, but we know there was an enormous amount of lobbying, and we know they were pushing very hard to limit the extent to which the OECD did actually go beyond the arm's length principle. So here we are.
Here we are, yeah. So lower income countries already tried to propose something like this combined worldwide reporting in the OECD, the not so inclusive OECD, which is after all a rich countries club. Would it be easier or harder for countries rather than a US state like Minnesota to implement this?
You know, it'll be interesting to see which is the next US state to consider this, given how much revenue it's likely to generate. For countries, though, there is a limitation, which is that most countries have a significant number of double tax treaties that probably makes it impossible to go straight to a unitary approach of this sort and simply tax your share of the global profits. Now, that doesn't mean that no one should do it. What it means is you probably want to do it in a group of like-minded countries and agree together that you will set aside these treaties. The European Union is still taking forward its BEFIT proposal, which would effectively do this within the EU. And there's a question there about whether that can be extended, as in the Minnesota proposal, to a worldwide combined reporting basis.
BEFIT, that's the EU's Business in Europe framework for income taxation. It's supposed to be a single corporate tax rule book for the EU, providing for fairer allocation of taxing rights between member states. So where do the G24 group of lower income countries go? I mean, we all know the OECD isn't the place to get what they want. So how about the United Nations?
There's also the process now around the proposal for a UN framework on international tax cooperation. We know that both the African and the Latin American and Caribbean regional discussions have included the possibility of pushing for unitary taxation, which could be done at the regional or the UN, the full global level. So in a sense, if things get blocked by some OECD member countries, for example, within the UN process, we could see regional moves to jointly, unilaterally move towards unitary taxation in this sort. So there's a lot to play for. There's a huge amount of revenue involved. In effect, the $312 billion, that's our last estimate for the annual tax revenue losses due to corporate tax abuse by multinationals, that would more or less be available to be reclaimed if countries switch to a unitary taxation basis. Bigger amounts of money in high-income countries, but a bigger share of current tax revenues in lower-income countries, so really a pretty strong incentive for everyone to make that shift. And it's only the lobbying that continues to hold that very sensible step back. This year might be the year that we see that dam start to crack, particularly within the UN process and the related discussions, whether or not this proposal starts to become more concretely possible. Minnesota might just be an early sign that this could be on the way.
Let's hope. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Thanks for joining me. We'll be back with you next month.